Hello and welcome to High Low, a Kurosaw podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is he's a young man. He's going to college, and he's trying to make the best out of the situation. And he just moved into a not great apartment.
Listen, I just want to study and get on with my life, and I don't want to have to deal with gangsters like you. Or in this scenario, are you the lady with the pretty dress? Hey, Spencer, looking pretty good there.
No, I'm Joe the killer in this scenario.
Oh, no. Hey, Spencer, you're looking pretty good as Nakadai there.
Oh, yeah. Young Nakadai, you know, looks good. Just like old Nakadai looks good.
Yeah, he's been a heartthrob for decades now. When's he going to stop?
Hopefully not.
You even look at that old man version, you're like, hey, man, what's going on?
Yeah. And with us today is... today is John Cribbs from the Pink Smoke from the Redbeard episode. Hello, John.
Hey, guys. Great to be back. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. So this episode is the second part of the 1957 pairing. We first did Throne of Blood, the Macbeth horror adaptation. Pairing that up with Black River from 1957. It's the big breakout for Nakadai, who had been in a couple movies before this. Like Seven Samurai was his first movie ever that was released, and he did some Kobayashi stuff in between, and then this was kind of like the big breakout for Nakadai when people were like, oh no, this guy's legit.
Yeah, and like you said, he comes out looking great. The sideburns and the sunglasses. Mm-hmm. He even rocks like a flannel shirt late in the movie, I think, and pulls it off somehow. He's eye candy in this movie.
Yeah, I never see him so young. You know, I've seen Seven Samurai, but I'm never sure where he is in Seven Samurai. But like in this, it's like, oh no, this is like he's not a superstar yet because Toshiro is still around and taking up that place, and like yeah, this is just like, Toshiro has a competition.
On Strong, I think that do you guys think he's the hero of this movie? And if not, who is? You know, I mean, I know that he's not the protagonist we're supposed to be siding with exactly, but he's got all the charisma in his corner. He's a horrible person, but he's somehow weirdly likable. I think it's just his film from beginning to end. I don't think anyone even tries to take it away from him.
No, I don't. I mean, hero's the wrong word. He's not the hero. I think he does. It would be hard to separate him from, you know, being the protagonist. Like, I guess if I had to pick somebody who I thought was the most important character of it, it would be Eneko Arima as Shizuko.
Yeah. But, oh, I need to point out, she was in another movie we covered from 1957. You know which one we're talking about, Joel?
Yeah, Tokyo Twilight.
Yeah.
She's the sister.
Mm-hmm. She's the one who...
That's a spoiler alert. Gets hit by a train or something like that.
Yeah. That one.
Speaking of getting hit by trains, before I forget, and not to spoil this movie outright, didn't we watch a different movie where somebody got hit by a military truck?
Yes, I can't remember which one.
Yeah, that's the problem. I was trying to remember. Because it was the Yoshishito one. Because it came out of nowhere in that movie, and I remember being like, what the hell?
Yeah, I think it may have been, what was that Joe Shishio movie? Like, Detective Bureau 123, Go to Hell, Bastards?
Yeah, that wasn't it, though. It was something more serious than that. I'll look.
Yeah, we've covered so much, I'm not really sure. But,
Was it MASH? Are you thinking of MASH?
Yes, it was MASH.
This is Kobayashi too. His kind of his breakthrough movie, right? Masaki Kobayashi. He had made The Thick-Walled Room, which is, you know, a very brutal prison film. That's a post-war prison film about Japanese soldiers who have been indicted for crimes against humanity, who are, you know, together and suffering in prison. But that one had been delayed, I think. It came out, it was originally filmed in 53 and then came out right before this movie did, just because it was not, you know, a very, it was considered not a very moralistic film to come out to in Japan at the time. But this is the one I think that really he makes his statement on, right? He did I Will Buy You the year before, which is a phenomenal movie. Have you guys seen that one?
No, this is my first Kobayashi.
Your first Kobayashi ever?
Yeah, ever.
Wow, I thought you'd said that. I thought you had meant for this podcast. Like, I didn't, wow.
Yeah, what was it? I've seen the remake of Harikari and Harikiri, and that's kind of closest. I didn't know that was a remake until we did the Nakadai episode and Tony Stella said how much he hated the remake. And I was like, oh, fuck, I didn't know that was a remake. And yeah, that's kind of the closest to.
Yeah, that's the only, that's the only one I've seen. Yeah.
I'm envious. You guys have got some great movies ahead of you then. You know, obviously Kobayashi comes up. He's clearly not as worldly recognized as Kurosawa. You know, you can't blame, you know, the world for that. But I think that he's every bit as important a Japanese filmmaker. I think that it's easy to say they have parallel careers based on the times they were working together, their collaborations, and the different actors that they both used, and a lot of the same themes that they were tackling. But I think that Kurosawa has more of a universal appeal because all of that was kind of hidden behind these great adventure stories where you still... you don't have to really know the background or the social makeup that's happening at the time. Kobayashi, though, really takes these by the horns, starting with this film where he's jumping on post-war Japan, where he's really talking about the influence of the Allied occupation within that society, which is something that Kurosawa, I don't think, ever really tackles head-on. The effects of the war in Kurosawa films come out in things like I Live in Fear, or later on in Dreams, where you kind of see the individual psychological toll that's taking place. But
yeah, and to actually see in August too.
Yeah,
it was with the aftermath of the war. But yeah, right. This feels, I'm not sure if ever Kobayashi liked this, but this feels very angry compared to like Kurosawa in terms of like dealing with the post-war world. Post.
It definitely does. Yeah, I think that. Obviously, the comparison, I don't know too many specific Japanese movies that are set post-war, like right after the war and during the occupation, but In Memoriam, Pigs and Battleships is the one that's most, you know, that jumps into your mind immediately, and is even more angry, possibly, than this one.
Yeah, it's also a lot more wacky and more, easier pill to take.
It's true, it definitely kind of flies out there a little bit more, kind of lets itself have some fun. But this one, I feel like it's Kobayashi. When you've seen Kobayashi's other films, it's really him's just sort of gearing up towards where he's going to go, where he's kind of dipping his foot in the water more than anything. You know, like he's showing you what's happening. He's kind of setting you up so the Nakadai character is sort of embodying this, you know, occupation or this American influence that's happening, all the corruption that's happening because of it, and how his preying on the different characters is sort of a direct, you know, thing to the indirect influence of the Americans stationed in Japan at the time. But at the same time, it's a very straightforward story. There's, like you said, there's nothing really fun or loose about it the way that In Memoriam would do it later on. So it's sort of setting the stage, I feel, at this time, at the point in his career, when he goes back to feudal Japan with seppuku and with rebellion and with and then even with The Human Condition, which is, you know, his big wartime film that's he makes right after this. That's when he's really like getting into the kind of corruption and the kind of lies that he wants to really attack. This one just seems sort of like a dress rehearsal for it. It's still a great movie, though. It's still a great movie, but I think that's why I said you guys are really in for a treat when you get to his later stuff, because I feel like he's still just gearing up at this point.
like this was just a for me a big surprise. I knew Nakadai was in it because I knew he and Kobayashi worked together a whole bunch, but like overall I did really like this whole lot. It felt like a precursor to things like Pix and Battleships, and I feel kind of like a bit of a Battles with Honor and Humanity a little bit, gearing up to that. Fukasaku is also a very angry filmmaker, possibly more angry than Imamura.
Yeah, I feel like he's definitely still setting the stage at this point. Like I said, like you're not going to get a fully fleshed out idea from this film. I think that he's more interested in kind of just showing how things are, how the characters are relating to their, you know, the current situation. He delves into prostitution, which was, you know, rampant at the time, because they even set up, they even allowed the Japanese government at the beginning to set up like actual prostitution facilities, which were called Recreation and Amusement Associations, or the RAA. So soldiers could just go and, you know, get their rocks off. And the idea was then they won't go around raping women left and right. But of course, MacArthur ended up closing that down when venereal disease became rampant. So,
yeah, I read all about that stuff when I, for my site, did the Rico trilogy, which is basically about the aftermath of the children of the rape from Americans. And that's the whole weird. It taps into that whole thing a bit, and taps into us like the post-war world of how Americans kind of this were abusing the system and just taking advantage of the people. And you have the people who are maybe this is kind of a naive take on it, but I see it as like Nakadai represents like the siding with the Americans and becoming more Western, where the lead character, who was it, Fumio Watanabe, he is more, and at least initially, like he's more traditional, and he's kind of representing like siding with the like the rebellion almost.
Siding with the, yeah, well, he's just kind of neutral, right? He kind of just wants to be doing his own thing and kind of gets embroiled in all of this. He's a bookseller who's also a student, and the only reason that he gets involved with any of this stuff is that he wants to save money by moving into this slum-like apartment building near a beer hall, which is rented to him, it should be noted, by an unscrupulous landlady who played the unscrupulous landlady in Lower Depths. The same year, the Kurosawa film, same actress. But she, in that one, of course, you know, she's out to get Shira Mifune and cause trouble for everybody. And in this one, she's, you know, going to get the red. It's funny because you do see a little bit of the balance that Kobayashi wants to create. The villains of this movie are absolutely corrupt and absolutely, you know, hissable. But at the same time, you know, she comes around and all the tenants are all horrible. They're the absolute worst people. She's coming to collect the rent and they're all dodging her. They're calling her names. They're just awful. And you kind of feel for her that, of course, who wouldn't want to sell this at the first opportunity, sell this and get rid of it, wash your hands of it and not give a shit, you know, which of these people you make homeless, because so many of them are just the absolute worst. But she's terrific in the movie. And I just like that parallel, that the same year, 1957, you know, the Lower Depths was coming out at the same time, and she was playing the landlady in that as well.
Yeah.
Actress is Suzu Yamada.
Yamada. There you go.
Yeah, and adding to, like, the 57 connection, you have, I forgot her name already. She's from Tokyo Twilight, who's playing a similar character who's kind of stuck in a shitty situation and is trying to make the best of it.
Yeah, Nico Arima is her name. Yeah. She'd started with Mifune in a salaryman comedy called Sunflower Girl, which was released in Europe as Love in a Teacup. Just a few years earlier, and then of course went on to, as you guys were mentioning, being an actress for Ozu and Kinoshita, and then she did a miniseries just last year. She's still around, so still kicking it. She mentioned also that Yamada played the Lady Macbeth character in Throne of Blood. She was Lady Asahi in that movie.
Okay, I usually look familiar for more than just the lower depths.
Right, that's like her most famous role, I would guess. But when I said that Nakadai is Killer Joe is the quote unquote hero, I really mean that, like, I think that Kobayashi makes Fumio's bookseller and Arima's parasol carrying waitress such bland characters. they're so boring. And it takes Fumio so long to, like, step up to these guys who are just harassing him left and right and who are, he just gets pushed around for so long.
Yeah, there are stretches where Nakadai once drew up where just, like, man, this character's really boring. But, like, felt like it was not done the best because the character was so bland, and it was kind of like, I feel like some parts was a little too much time with the bland characters, like their romance. Like it's more nitpicky stuff. Like the romance never seemed that real. It's kind of like they got settled for each other because they're the only, like, nice people, or at least like a neutral people in area.
Who are you talking about? You talking about the main lady and the,
yes,
the architect student or whatever he's trying to be, engineering student?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly what that was, right? They both ended up in a terrible situation. Now they're both grasping at the only sensible or nice people that they have seemed to have left in the world, except for both of them are started out that way, and they've been corrupted by just being in this area. You know, her just happened to have walked the same path over and over again to catch the eye of this evil person, and him moving into this, you know, slum apartment is not even the correct word, because it wouldn't even qualify like that, with a whole bunch of people who are desperate and are constantly lying and cheating and doing all this other stuff, and he can't help but become, you know, somebody who's aggressively standing, but I don't know, not necessarily the good, like, I wouldn't call him the good guy either, or this, you know, we were talking about hero, like, he's
there's no hero.
Definitely not the good guy.
Yeah.
Definitely not the good guy.
Because if he was the quote unquote good guy of a film like this, as we'd imagine, he probably would have been, you know, I'm going to rescue you kind of thing. And that's not what happens, because he's a man and he's treated more realistically, which is like, oh, she's with that guy now, she's dirty, you know, and he comes out and says that, basically, you've been with him a whole bunch of times, and, like,
after she tells him how she was tricked and sexually assaulted, he's like, oh, how many times you had sex with him? Mm-hmm. What a piece of shit.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, and then he's like, why didn't you report it? And she says, well, I'd be probably shamed for that, which was... Well, it will always be relevant, probably, because if society stays the same. But that's just real, like, this guy fucking sucks.
Yeah, his response, like her, when she says that, like, I'd be publicly ashamed and I'd be miserable, and he's like, "Aren't you miserable now?" Like, fuck you.
It all ties in though to, like, what was happening at that time with, you know, again, the way women were treated, you know, in post-war Japan. You got the other tenant, the really nice guy who's kind of like an optimistic fool, Okada, who has the wife, Yusuko, right? Who he doesn't realize is secretly, you know, hooking behind his back. You have women who, you know, had no problem going out and realizing that the best money to be made out there was with the flesh. And even the whole idea of knocking down the slum to put up a love hotel, right, for for the Americans at the nearby camp. The whole idea is that, you know, if you don't have something that people want, you're going to be poor and you're going to be kicked out of your slum, you know. So I think that what he was going for, maybe I'm trying to come around to this with the bookseller, is that he's showing that he's like sort of the whole outlook of Japan at the time, which is that he's not there to protect this pure woman with the parasol, but as soon as she is preyed upon, as soon as she is forced to, you know, live this life where she is, you know, being corrupted by this other man, it's her fault. She's the, you know, he's victim blaming her, and she's dirty now, and she's not this ideal person. It's interesting because they both kind of idealize her in the same way. Joe's kind of set himself up at the, you know, top of this public works building, and he's looking down at all the people as they're passing, and he just sees her parasol, but he, you know, glares at her every day. And then the student kind of has the same thing where he idealizes her to like a degree that he thinks she's this perfect person. And then when he finds out she's not, that's how he's going to react. So maybe that's the kind of characterization that was trying to build up here. But the result, of course, is that the guy just seems like a total knob for the entire movie.
Yeah, and going back to like Nakadai in a tower and the student in the slum on the ground, like it's a very not so subtle symbol of Nakadai is on top. He has money. He's a sellout, and this guy is trying to just live his life without an opinion.
And he's the Gondo of this movie, right? He's the Gondo. He's the high and low character, yeah, up in his mansion on the hill, looking down at all the poor schlubs.
Yeah, except he's more of a outright shitty person, where in high and low, Gondo has some redeeming qualities towards the end.
Oh, of course. No, that's where Joe wants to be. You know, Joe wants to be above everybody else, whereas I feel Gondo is just, you know, a victim of success is all he is. Have you guys seen the William Friedkin movie Killer Joe?
Yes, I have.
I have not.
I couldn't stop thinking about during this how, you know, it's also a movie about like a very slick, very self-stylized, you know, killer character who preys upon a young woman, you know, similar to this one. I admit, it just might be that they have the same name, but I couldn't help thinking that.
Yeah, well, yeah. There's that part where he makes her put a piece of water. Well, you know, anyway.
Yeah, they're just saying where you get to. I've got too gross. Kind of talk about Jane Krishan shot where she's pantsless.
Sure. Nothing as bad as that in this 1957 movie.
But I'm surprised with just what they got away with like setting up the. You don't see like the sexual assault. Well, it's a rape and where she's passed out, and you don't see it, but it's hinted that. And I was pretty shocked that this was the, like in the movie, period. Like this was allowed at the time.
Yeah, well, like you guys said, I think before we started recording, you see this kind of thing in a lot of the Japanese films set in the post-war. They really didn't want to. They want to glamorize it in any way. They want to make sure that you saw all the kind of things that were going on, which was just an everyday occurrence. There was something, there was an insane amount of sexual assault going on at the time. I don't know the statistics, but I think it says something that, you know, a lot of your post-war European thrillers or American thrillers like The Third Man or Berlin Express, you know, are these kind of fun adventure stories. And then you're, post-war Japanese films, you get the Burmese Harp, Fire on the Plains, Black Rain, you know, movies that are not fun. They're not fun movies. They're masterpieces, but they're not enjoyable.
You get picked in battleships, which is fun.
Yeah, but that's got all kinds of dark things going on in it too.
It's got much more graphic rape than that one.
Yeah. I mean, people get squished to death by pigs, so.
That's the end of the movie, though. you're talking about like the entire movie is a laugh a minute, but
it compared to the rest of like the post-war Japan movies, it's the easiest one to watch because there's that weird more comedy in it. Like you try to make it palatable, where this is like this is what's going on.
And, you know, I'd say it's like it's more it's easier to take than the pornographers, you know, in comparison. Like the pornographers has parts where it's absolutely kind of skin crawling, you know, while you're still, you can't look away from the screen. And Pigs and Battleships has more of a more relatable parts, I'd have to say. Even though there's, you know, the horrible things going on, there are some people that are kind of normal.
But yeah. I mean, Pornographer is another post-war movie that's kind of ultimately depressing.
But I agree with you. Pigs and Battleships, Pornographers, Ballad of Narayama. I think that, you know, Momura was such an amazing filmmaker that he could have fun and funny scenes in movies that are ultimately skin crawling and horrible. I think that's definitely something he was, it was his forte. It's what he was good at.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the tenets of this slum for a minute, because they're kind of a fun and eclectic group of characters. Yeah. Have you guys ever had a situation where you lived with more than one person and you had to divvy up the phone bill like these guys have to do with the waste removal bill?
I have not.
You're lucky. Definitely. Joel, have.
You?
No, I have not. I mean, unless you count living with, you know, my significant other, I guess, but not multiple people.
No, not like a situation like I brought up in the last episode, where Ozu, Gosho, and Shimizu all live together in a house when they're making moves in the 20s.
Yeah, those guys had to pay for all kinds of waste disposal.
Yeah, I mean, Ozu was probably drinking all the time because he's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I mean, he was.
Bottles all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, I make Aaron Cornelius pay for a bunch of things even though he doesn't live here. I guess that kind of counts, you know.
Yeah. But my favorite tenant was the gambler, who was Adriel Tono, who was also, I believe he was also a pimp too, but he was like the, besides the guy, what's his name, whose wife was a prostitute. I wrote his name somewhere.
Oh, Akato?
Yeah. Like Akato and the gambler. I guess the gambler had a name, but I never caught it. Like, they were like the most like likable, much friendly people. Like, even though you never see Tono outside the apartment place, where it's like, you know, he's probably being horrible to women because he's also a pimp, but like he still like was genuinely nice to everyone at the apartment place in the whole apartment building.
Yeah, that's a great scene too, where he throws the card up that sticks to the ceiling, and the landlady drops her guard for that split second to say "Wow," right before she starts digging back into him to ask for the rent. It's a nice moment. There's the guy who's suffering from, he's dying of TB, which I think is a staple of a lot of Japanese films from this time. You know, how the rampant corruption manifests itself in a character who's suffering from a debilitating illness. We see that in Pigs and Battleships. Kobayashi used it again in I Will Buy You and in The Inheritance. It's just sort of like a little symbolic character thrown into the mix, you know, who is rotting on the inside, just as these characters are, and society is rotting from the outside around them.
Yeah, well, so there was like, there are a bunch of gossipy women who were they were fun. They were kind of comical. They were as close as a comedy the movie got to.
Yeah, and they're not uniting together in any way. You know, it's not going to be a "Rich Jerks are closing down the dance hall, we got to put on a show so we don't lose our creative outlet" movie. This is just like these guys are hopeless trying to do anything.
Yeah, I haven't seen much noir, but this feels like basically it's a noir set in post-war Japan.
Oh, really? I guess a little bit.
Like the
stuff with Joe is definitely noirish.
And then like the other stuff is kind of like it's like more like political drama, but like But with Joe, I got a noir feel, and I opened with like this dark jazzy music, which was an indication to me, that felt like it's just, this will be about the American occupation. Every time I hear jazz in a movie, Japanese movie from this era, it usually means it's going to deal with the Americans in some way.
It's a little too disorganized to be noir, because I feel like, especially the noirs that I've seen from Japan, we focus on one guy, basically, who's on a mission to do something, whether good or bad. And this is, like I said, we don't really have a character we're focusing on. We have a character that we want to focus on, you know, Nakadai's character, but I wouldn't say, you know, like that. There's no mystery to solve or anything like that. It does feel like, I mean, because it takes place in the same time era as, like, Take Aim at the Police Van or one of those movies. But that's about it. I my favorite character from the slum there is Okada's wife. Like, Okada, mm-hmm. I don't like very much because he's a weirdo and he pushes her around. But I like how she keeps getting into these situations where she's getting caught. Like, you know, sneaking into the young guy's room and, you know, obviously trying to position herself in some way where he's going to be, you know, looking up her skirt or something like that. He's just not interested. And then later when we follow those, or that one American gets taken to the whorehouse and she just happens to be there. I'm like, hey, I'm here. And he's like, what the? Her husband. And then at the very end, when she's just like, you know what? I'm out of here. I'm going to sign my picture and I'm gone.
She's definitely got it figured out, right? I mean, like, if you have to, like, be in this situation where, you know, there's everyone's starving and there's no nobody's, there are no jobs and no one's making any money, and literally prostitution is the only way to turn, like, she's the one who's got it worked out. You know, she can pack up and leave whenever she wants. She can hitch into, you know, the main part of Tokyo, whatever. Yeah, I definitely, like, admired, like, that confidence in her, even though, you know, it's sad. At the same time, there's, like, definitely a deep sadness that Okada is so into her, and that she obviously is not the kind of woman to take home, you know, not the kind of woman who's going to cook you food and give you a foot rub or whatever it is he's expecting.
Like, she was the most, besides Joe, she is the most confident character and the most self-assured character, and it was a weird juxtaposition compared to her husband, who was clearly very insecure. And like immediately you get the feeling of, like, when you first meet him and talks about his wife, it's like, I got the feeling at least of, oh, this will not end well. Like, I have that's the way he's talking about her, and like her great job was like, okay, she's cheating on him, or she's a prostitute, and this will be a major thing later on. But, like, he turns out to be, you know, kind of yet another scumbag in this. But he's not, like, he's not in the gang he's not in Joe's gang, but he's still, you know, enough of a scumbag that he would fit in there.
Yeah, Joe's gang, that's an interesting bunch as well. I feel like, you know, with I'd be in Joe's gang. Like, he just seems like such a cool guy. You know, I know we see him, you know, rape a woman and, you know, plot to, you know, make all these people homeless. Nothing he does is advisable at all. But he's just, like, such a cool guy. And it's, but all the American influences on, you know, the way he looks, like a cool, you know, wearing the sunglasses, listening to the jazz. And at one point, for some reason, I don't know if you guys noticed this, when we're in Joe's gang and he's attacking the other woman who hangs out with him, the other girl who's into him, you hear Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen playing in the background of all things.
Yeah, I did notice that.
That's a strange music.
Yeah, I think that's another indication of he's very Americanized by this point. But let's see, where was it? But yeah, his gang was just really strange because it was made up of some people who lived in the slums, and it was like some people lived in slums and just some other random guys who were like always shirtless, because I guess it was really hot. Like it wasn't like Onibaba, where like you could feel the heat off the screen, but it still, you know, it gave like a real indication of like this is a very conflicted area. It's a very conflicted area politically and like temperature wise, because it's also just uncomfortably hot for everyone. So everyone's going to be on edge more so.
Yeah,
it's so hot.
Yeah, that opening shot with the women just collapsed on the ground from heat exhaustion reminded me of the famous shot from Stray Dog with all the showgirls who come off stage and immediately, you know, fall into the floor and are just lying there like a big mass of bodies, you know, just sweating and being horribly uncomfortable. So you definitely feel that kind of oppressive heat in the movie.
You know, I didn't really like his gang. They have no personality amongst them, which I guess is how you become part of the gang.
Yeah. Well, Snockadai, you're not going to, you'll absorb your personality.
Yeah, I know, but there's nothing going on for these guys. I mean, they just follow.
There's the one guy.
Which one guy? Stop.
The one guy
get out of here.
There's the one guy who like tipped off the student. He was like, oh, Joe was around.
Well, he's the one guy who lives in the slum apartment.
Yeah, he's
the only guy. So I almost felt like he was not part of the gang. And then, like, when they originally came snooping around to see if this was something that they could easily, you know, target and get rid of people from, that he joined up on them because he was willing to, you know, be devious, just as devious as them. He's the exception, but I don't even feel like he's really a gang member. I feel like after the tenement's been torn down and everyone has get paid, that they're probably just going to kick his ass out. But
it's kind of like a male version, too, of Yusuko, right? Of the wife who's prostituting herself, because he's figured that the one way to go with the winner is Joe, right? They're like the way to actually make money and not be preyed upon by all the people who are taking advantage of this atmosphere, this environment, is to go with Joe and become a Yakuza and hang out in the top of his tower and gamble all day and, you know, not have to worry about anything. Get thrown 30,000 yen and, oh, you have to move out of your apartment. Okay, whatever. It's just sort of the two different distinctions. Is like, you know, you can either be a victim or you can be a victimizer in this environment.
Yeah, going back to Imamura.
Exactly, yeah.
Relationship, but I wrote my notes Blue Velvet. I'm not sure why, but like some parts kind of rhyme Blue Velvet, but I can't pinpoint exactly.
I think you can make the connections of like the abusive weirdo and the younger kind of innocent looking man getting caught up in the thing, you know. There's no equivalent for the Laura Dern. They can, you know, combine Laura Dern and
Isabella Rossellini.
Yeah, into one character. Like, if Laura Dern's character had become Isabella Rossellini, which in a David Lynch movie is perfectly possible, but it's not too far a stretch.
It's not quite as hedonistic as the Dean Stockwell party, but the scene where he takes her dancing in the brothel, the bordello, whatever it's supposed to be, the club, you know, where he's like, there's about to be a strip tease and all the Americans go crazy. And when she tries to get away from him and opens up the curtain, and then sure enough, like all the Americans are getting naked and hooting and hollering and whatnot.
Yeah, and like
somewhat like the sleaze factor is sort of Blue Velvet-esque, I would agree.
Yeah, a little bit. And I just noticed this yesterday. So your partner in crime, John, Chris, he was on episode High and Low, which is a post-war movie that has a black man in it. And this movie is a post-war movie with a black man in it. And there aren't very many of those.
Not very many Japanese post-war movies with black actors. Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, I was wondering, the white client of the brothel, I was wondering if it was the exact same actor they used in Pigs and Battleship. He looks exactly the same.
That's plausible.
Like the big dumb, you know, guy with the crew cut.
you know, like, I forgot where I read this, but apparently it was, they just, like, go to a base and, like, just ask around, like, who wants to be in a movie, and that was kind of how they picked Americans. Like, it wasn't, like, necessarily actors, it's kind of just, like, they would need just, like, you know, a Westerner to show up in a scene or two.
You'll be very poorly dubbed. That was the sell.
Yeah. Oh, but, like, after the moment when she's trying to escape the scene, and, like, the Americans are stripping naked, and, like, it just sees, like, I'm not sure if that's purposeful or not, but she sees this, like, you know, this American, like, dark-skinned black man is, like, kind of, like, lustfully leer at her, and then she, like, goes back to Joe. I'm not sure if that was, like, purposeful, like, playing on, like, American stereotypes and racism or not, but it kind of felt like that.
I could see that. I think that, you know, a goody two-shoes who's never been in a club before, you know, who's just like a waitress, this quiet, you know, diner, would go to a place like that and see like a giant black GI and be freaked out by it. I agree that that was probably a purposeful on his part. I hope it wasn't meant to be like, you know, the ultimate decadence for Japanese women is a giant black guy. I'd like to think that wasn't the intention.
I mean,
that's like, the intention of many American movies, I should point out. Requiem for a Dream, 13. Lots of movies where the woman's her very bottom, when she hits ground bottom, is when she has sex with a black guy. Something that Chris and I like to talk about a lot. It's an unfortunate trope in a lot of American films.
I never realized that until just now.
I feel like it's more a, you know, when she steps out in the hallway and it's like the alternative is Joe or that situation. It might be nodding towards like, well, we know the Americans are crazy and they just will do something terrible to you and get away with it because they're the Americans. And she, you know, takes one look at that. It's like, I'm not even going to risk it. I'm going to go back to this person who raped me and abused me already. You know, it could have, yeah. Like, that's me reaching, but that's...
No,
yeah,
I think that's exactly it. I think it's, you know...
It's the danger the environment that she is, knows and understands. And
exactly.
Americans, it's, you know, she doesn't know what will happen if she gets involved with the Americans directly.
It's the same reason that everybody runs to Joe, right? To, like, not be the victim.
Right.
That she can either, you know, be in this environment where she could be pulled into an alley and raped by a serviceman at any point. Or this guy will protect her even though he beats her and rapes her and treats her like shit.
Right. And she could either walk around, you know, never talk to him again and have this stained reputation that she knows, like, she is going to have no matter what. And so she could either have that reputation and have nothing to do with him or have that reputation and be with him and have nobody ever say that to her face because they know Joe, well, you know, is always going to be there to bite them or whatever.
Well, you see, too, that she is so desperate immediately to, like, not have this tarnished reputation that she goes to him the night after he rapes her and says, will you marry me? You know, she wants to make, you know, make it a legitimate relationship.
Yeah,
right away.
That was kind of crazy. Like,
yeah,
I don't.
And
that doesn't come up very often I can't think of another movie we watched where there was a situation where somebody had sex with somebody else, whether it was, it was consenting relationship or not, where they immediately went, well, I guess we're getting married now. Made me think of friggin' Worf on Star Trek being like, now that we've had relations, we must get married. Like, whoa, you're a Klingon warrior. What? Just to nerd out for a second.
You haven't brought up Deep Space Nine in a while.
I've been feeling like rewatching it recently, so I, you know, maybe I need to get a life.
Yeah. Guys, I'm in the middle of watching it for the first time ever.
What do you think?
Dude, I love it. I absolutely love it.
That's so good. I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Because it gets crapped on so much, and this is the first one that really clicked with me. Like, I like the original, and I like Next Gen. And back in the day, I liked Voyager, but this one I was like, wow, this is really good. And I don't know why. It's just super enjoyable.
It is. I'm enjoying the hell out of it.
Well,
so Spencer, get on that train.
Yeah. It takes me forever to get through TV shows. Like I'm three episodes into She's Gonna Have It, the series, and it took me like 5 months to get through three episodes.
Oh man, that's really good too. Come on.
I know. It's great. It's just I'm bad with watching TV. I feel weird guilt about it.
But I'm the same way. I'm the same way. It's taking me forever to watch DS9.
But movies, I have a weird thing. I'm like, oh, I can watch this 3-hour movie. That's fine. But like a half hour TV show, like, no, that's a waste of time.
Yeah.
I can't explain why I feel that way, but
I understand that. Like when it comes to a commitment level, I feel like if you tell somebody you watched these two movies in one day and they both, you know, you've got these things to talk about. Nobody's going to be like, wow, you watched two movies. But if you say like, oh, I watched 3 hours of television, like, holy crap, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
So in Shotoku's defense, you know, I agree. I think it's the evil that she knows that she wants to stick with, but I think she's just also taken her by complete surprise that, you know, this guy would want to prey on her the way that he has, and not just prey on her, but kind of insist that he loves her and that he wants to protect her. And that scene in the restaurant where, you know, she's trying to get rid of him and he's like, I'll wait for you to get off work, and he won't go away. That's, I'd say that's definitely some Frank Booth behavior there.
Oh, yeah. There's no dry humping in jeans, though.
Not that we see.
There was in my house. No, just kidding. It's, yeah, I mean, it's just a disgusting manipulative behavior of people that want to control other people. And like, yeah, Nakadai is such a good actor, and I've seen him in so many roles where he's just this gross dude that, and for some reason it's never like stayed on him as a person. It's like these are just all characters he's playing, and I can't get enough. So,
yeah, I mean,
has he ever been this gross though? Because even when he's a villain in Sanjuro and in Rebellion, he's still like there's a nobility to him. Like there's a sense of honor, you know.
I'd say sort of Doom. He might be worse because he just indiscriminately will kill anyone.
Yeah,
in his way,
and he totally rapes.
I guess so, but he's almost. Yeah, but he's almost like evil personified in that film.
That's true. Yeah. And Scandalous Adventures of Boracay.
Oh yeah, he's a bit more. Well, he's still shitty in that one.
He's real shitty.
And he might be attracted to his mom, because that one scene where he sees her naked.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, the scene, and right after, like he tells his mom he found the love of his life with a prostitute who doesn't think his foreskin is weird.
That's what makes you think his mom has been saying something about his foreskin being weird.
Yeah, he says like this first woman who thinks my foreskin isn't weird.
And he's a pretty big piece of shit in the face of another.
Yeah, what scene in this movie reminded you guys of John Carpenter?
Can't think of any RF fan.
When they're checking around to see what everyone's blood type is.
Oh. And everybody doesn't have the correct one. Yeah.
Or is willing to admit that they do, but won't give blood. This guy's the main character. This is the guy we're supposed to be sympathetic with. He's willing to admit that he has the correct blood, but says, "But I'm not going to give you any of my blood."
Yeah, he does a real my shit doesn't stink kind of thing there. You know.
Like, yeah, he has a real he doesn't. I don't think he shows a real uppity attitude that much, but in certain key moments, that attitude really does shine. In this moment, definitely he gets this sense of he thinks he's better than them. And then I think then someone points out the wife of the man says that some points out that the wife who was looking for blood.
Yeah, this is pretty like, funny.
Well, isn't your blood type the right one? And even she doesn't want to participate.
Yeah, it's the guy you were saying that you like this gambler guy. I hate that gambler guy because
I just like Eiichiro Otono. He's a whole lot of fun.
Oh, I know the actor's good, but I think he's that guy. The character in this movie is a total dickhead. But he is the one who's fine. Like, stop it! He said he's not going to do it. Besides, you've got the right blood type. What's your problem?
Yeah, which raises the question of how does he know that exactly? But who cares? It doesn't really matter.
Oh, he's a pimp. You need to know these kind of things.
Yeah.
And he's one of those guys who can tell just by looking in your face what you're about to
ask. Yeah, and he has a wife and a child, too.
That must be like a registration thing, like a military type thing after the occupation began. Like, we need people to register and we need to know their blood type or something like that. Because why else would they know?
Oh, I think it's a Japanese thing in general, because it even shows up in, like, character bios and Final Fantasy games. Like, blood type.
Yeah, but that also, I mean, those all came out after the occupation, at least I think so.
Yeah, I know. But I feel like it might be the after effect of this, like, recording.
Right.
Like, height, weight, blood type, all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, like, people were being categorized that way for a certain amount of time, and then it just became part of the culture, you know, the same way that, let's see.
But then you've got the one guy who says, I'm type C. So, who knows how familiar they are with blood types.
Yeah, that guy's a pretty, he's a genius, if you ask me. Because the doctor's like, type C. He's like, yep.
Yeah, and that scene, I think that's a scene where, like, they mentioned he's coughing up black blood, which means he's going to die, which is another, like, black blood, like, his body is, you know, corrupting from within. Another very clear symbol of that.
Well, they were saying that because he was coughing up black blood, he's not going to die. They were saying that, like, oh, that's just his body coughing up the bad blood. If it's red, that's when you know he's really in trouble.
Okay.
Right.
I'd write notes at that moment. Maybe. Okay. I was
but, you know, it's, they don't understand the situation. They don't know if that's the case. Like, you shouldn't be coughing up blood no matter the color.
Yeah. And I like that there's a constant reminder of the Americans, because they're right next to the base. So when a plane takes off, it's really loud.
Super loud, yeah.
I'm not sure if either you have lived like on an air base or near one, but
I grew up
in a military family, and it's very loud. And you kind of get used to it a little bit, but still irritating.
Yeah, I would imagine if you still did, it would be very, it would be not very conducive to podcasting.
Oh, no, not anymore. It's been years.
No.
But before, just like a lot louder than you would expect it to be if you don't know.
I mean, the place I live now, like, I've always lived next to kind of a major freeway, just a different distances. My childhood home. The place I live now, the freeway is, like, literally a block and a half over. Not to mention, beyond that, we have the ocean, which is constantly making noise. Of course, you drown that out eventually, but, oh, man, I remember...
That's another thing where I think that Immemora kind of, like, captures that a little bit better, having the action set within the more urban part of the city, where in that first shot of Pigs and Battleships, you just see, you know, that tracking shot where it's going through the city streets, and it's just a swarm of sailors and, you know, other military types just overwhelming the population. And you just realize what an impact it's had on this culture, just to have all these people going out and being loud and aggressive every single night, you know?
Yeah. And you know, the surrounding businesses all have changed. You know, I'm sure they were stores and stuff like that, but it's bar this and club that and whatever else this, that, you know, for specifically aimed towards getting sailors in to spend their money.
Yeah, it's 300,000 occupying servicemen, you know? It's like a whole other country of people suddenly at your front door. The culture shock is overwhelming.
Yeah.
I like to think about, you know, I'd love to read more about the Allied occupation. I know more about, you know, like the German occupation of France, you know, and obviously the big theme that comes out of that in artwork is collaboration and, you know, what people have to do to survive. The two choices being, you know, you either rebel against it or, you know, you do what you got to do to survive. You collaborate and you actually work with your enemy. I think in these films, though, and in films like Pigs and Battleship, it comes more to you can ignore what's going on and try not to be a part of it the way our bookseller does in this movie, and just try to live your life. And even Shimuzo with her parasol just walking around town. Or you can, you know, do something where you take it to your advantage. It's not exactly collaboration because it's not wartime. They're not enemies anymore, but you're trying to capitalize on the fact that these 100,000 people are suddenly here as and part of your culture. And so you turn to the black market, you turn to the prostitution, or raiding the base. Did either of you figure out what they were doing during that raid on the base? Were they getting, were they freeing prisoners? I couldn't tell exactly what was happening in that scene.
I'm not really sure either.
It was literally a whole bunch of different people who knew that a certain time would come by where men who wanted to sleep with Japanese prostitutes would run up to the demarcation line where Americans are not supposed to go past at a certain hour and Japanese are not supposed to go past at a certain hour. So a whole bunch of Americans run towards the fence in order to try to get underneath. And it wasn't the first, I felt like it wasn't obviously the first time it happened because they're like, they knew exactly which part of the fence to like take apart to pull this guy out so they can get some money. But
thank you, Joel. That's very enlightening.
The MPs that were following them were all Japanese soldiers. So I think it was the Japanese people were supposed to be, you know, guarding those posts.
That explains a lot. I'm glad that that's been explained.
A small detail that is not so subtle by like this particular detail is that there's a hole in the wall in the bookseller's apartment,
mm-hmm.
which is you know, like letting in.
You mean the hole that, in the wall he lives in?
Yeah, well, a little hole, but there's a little hole in a wall, and like there's some parts where people like stick their face in the space, and it's like a way of like kind of like
that it covers with a centerfold like Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, there's so much pornography pinned up all over this place, and they got children running around. But it doesn't matter that he's got that hole in the wall because all the neighbor has to do is like stand on their tippy toes and they kind of can see through the top part of these things or lean against the door. Like, oh man.
Yeah, but like having no cover is like another clear like sign of like the corruption is, you know, getting into where he lives and everything. He can't escape it.
Definitely. When they tear down the wall, when they finally get around to, you know, kicking everyone out and knocking down the building, I generally couldn't tell if it was an improvement or not.
Yeah. When in context of like time period would something like Good Morning be taking place? Like, are either of them period pieces or are they supposed to be like the year that they came out? Because Good Morning is 59, this is 57, and
I feel like this would have been up in between like 45 and 53, okay. 54.
Okay, so a little bit of a period piece going on.
Yeah, and Good Morning, it's Ozu, so it's probably like current day.
Right, you don't get any sense of like the war, you know, still being a thing that people are talking about in that movie, but it's like how obvious that the American influences are, you know, the kids who only want to watch television and the way everybody's dressed in that movie. You know, some people are still dressed in, you know, what you would consider traditional clothes, but most people are wearing regular t-shirts and pants and they're all pooping their pants or whatever. But it's just interesting, like the series of movies you've watched and like the progression of the traditional Japanese ways getting influenced by the West over and over again until like it's almost unrecognizable except for in like a museum sense.
Yeah, you still see it today. You still see the huge American influence on Japanese culture.
Right. It's not like, you know, you would literally have to be in a museum or something that's like a tea room that's specifically made to be an old style thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It just makes me sad.
Yeah. I understand. So, I think we should talk about the big climax in the movie.
Spoiler zone.
So, the tenements get their house torn down first.
Yeah.
Which is, Like talk about a house of cards falling down. That bulldozer barely has to tap the thing. That's a weird part where like those three guys, because when nice book guy moves in, he does kind of find one other person who's at least a decent person. He's the guy who's running the meetings. Like, oh, we need equal pay. Like, you guys need to be honest. And then but otherwise he doesn't really seem to have much in common with the other things. But at the end, he is running around with these other people, being like, no, we don't want this to happen. Okada and the honesty guy and book guy are trying to prevent the thing from being torn down. And it's based on his actions. I feel kind of like it comes out of nowhere, because he's really been like, I just want to be take care of my own thing. I don't want to have anybody else bother him. And I guess if motivation could be like, he's literally going to lose the place he's losing at if he doesn't do something. But he does seem to take a more aggressive turn.
Yeah, I think he's forced into doing so. And I have to say, I don't feel as bad for anyone in this movie as I do for that poor guy who has to run the house meetings and try to collect all the money on the bills. And at the end is like, who's with me? We could do this. And everyone's like, oh, sorry, I left my hairdresser or dryer on. I gotta go.
I have to talk
and
to my
everyone is just
husband first, yeah.
yeah, her fictional fucking husband. Everyone's just running around, doing their own thing and worried about their own shit. And he's actually trying to get something going. But I think, yeah, I think it's a cross between that and also, of course, the fact that he wants to stop Shimizu from murdering Joe, and that the two things just happen to tie directly into each other. That he goes to the birthday party kind of specifically to watch out for her. But while he's there, he's going to say, Joe, why don't you give some of that corrupt money that you got to the tenants that you just kicked out of their apartment?
Yeah, and I think in a different circumstance that wouldn't have been an unreasonable request for Joe, but I think that because they are having that battle of wills about Shimuza, is that what her name is? No, she's Izuku. That it's not something that is going to happen, obviously. But oh, what was I gonna say? Yeah, oh, sorry, that part, the honesty guy, when no one does anything, and finally he's just like, I can't take it anymore. He goes back into the house. I was like, oh no, I'm so sad.
I feel for that guy big time.
Yeah, his
Well,
wallet and watch.
to save face, yeah, he wanted to get his watch back from Joe and finally man up and show that he could drink sake like with the best of them and push people around. If he wanted to, I could have been doing this the whole time, seems to be his attitude at that point. But you see how Joe is like, even though he is antagonistic toward this guy, is immediately like, hey, join the gang, stay here since you lost your place. He just knows how to bring people over to him, to say, hey, if that shit didn't work out for you, how about things are working out pretty good for me? Why don't you join up with me?
Yeah, it's like he read him with the few times they've encountered each other, and he knew that this guy, even though he's acting, quote unquote, uptight, that he really is a little bit more like Joe than he wants to admit.
Yeah, well, I
Yeah.
think that the events of the movie kind of pushed him towards that. Just being in that shitty area made him more, like he started out neutral and then he's slowly becoming more and more corrupt. And yeah, like and Joe is possibly like the ultimate end result of what he could end up like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think too, but I really think that, trying not to get Parasol Girl out of this corruption, is a big part of it for him because she really is Japan in this movie, right? She really is that tradition of, what Japan was before the war and who's now being corrupted by this American influence through Killer Joe. He even offers to sell her to the bookseller at one point, for 100,000 yen, which is reminiscent of the of I Will Buy You, his Kobayashi's previous movie, where it's literally characters saying, I will buy your soul, like I will possess you like it's an object. And of course there's just the objectification of that parasol in the first place that we were talking about. And her reason too for wanting to kill Joe was she says she wants to kill the Joe that's inside of me. And she says that she loves the bookseller because I must love you so I can love myself. You know, she's trying to cling on to this thing in her that is uncorrupted and unblemished by the Joes of the world and also not fall into it. But I think he sees her killing Joe as crossing the line, and ultimately she won't be able to come back from it. You know, like, that's, at this point, nobody has been killed, right? It's been a lot of pushing people around and a lot of indifference and a lot of dirty business, but it hasn't been murder up to this point. Like, murder is really just pushing it way over the line. And I think that, you know, our pal, the bookseller, just wants to make sure she doesn't go that far, which he ultimately fails in doing.
Yeah, and her trying to kill Joe, like, for what feels like 20 minutes, and probably isn't, like, which is probably shorter than that, but, like, it's just teased out for such a long time, and it's just, like, the ultimate payoff for, you know, like, the whole tension between them. And it's, like, they go, like, location to location, and you get this, and it's just, like, is she going to kill him now? And you're not sure how she's going to kill him.
And yeah, it's drawn out where you don't know if she's going to poison him at the bar.
Dagger.
Or, yeah, the dagger comes into play.
And then you gotta keep seeing, like, the headlights of cars, and it's like, oh, I guess it's like, oh, 5 minutes left. I guess it must be a car.
And she pushes them out of the way of some of the trucks, too, which is just crazy. Like, you know, before she finally decides to do it. I think the bookseller would be fine, too, if he was the one to kill Joe. You know, I think he would be fine with that. I think he doesn't think Joe should live necessarily, but I think he's just trying to stop her from crossing the line during these scenes, which, you know, I guess that kind of builds up the tension that it's always him looking at her, suspecting what she's going to do next. It's kind of what leads everything up to the big finale where we lose our boy Nakadai, sadly.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think that this is such a thinly drawn character, this bookseller, that it's kind of hard to tell what the hell he's up to in the end, or what the events have actually pushed him to. Does he want to save the tenants? Does he want to save the girl? Does he want to kill Joe? Does he want to join Joe? You know, it's ambitious, I think, to a fault. I agree.
Yeah, he's a real basic boy.
Yeah,
extremely.
What's that fucking movie called? Comparing her to Japan is kind of like in the movie The Last Circus, the Spanish movie from, like, maybe 8 years ago. They were talking about, it's like set during the Civil War.
I don't know it. No?
No, not Civil War. It's set during Franco era Spain. Uh-huh. And it's like a circus, and, like, there's this kind of sleazy, corrupt guy who worked at the circus who represents, like, fascism. And there's this very sweet, innocent guy who represents, like, the Catholic Church and, like democracy, not democracy, whatever other form of government they have now. And, like, it's just, like, them fighting over this woman who basically represents Spain.
Is this the Alex de la Iglesia movie?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have not seen it, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, I can't remember his name because I'm never sure how to say Spanish names. But, yeah, it's... Yeah, kind of like this. It's not necessarily great, but it's very good, and it's a bit weirder, but his other movies are kind of weird, so you kind of know what you're in for if you're used to his style.
I'll have to check it out. No, I'm a fan of his, but I've not seen that one. But yeah, I think, you know, just with the level of symbolism going on with the characters, that approach here wouldn't surprise me. Joel, do you agree with me on it, or do you think it's a stretch?
I'm sorry, I was looking for a movie where somebody else got hit by a truck. What did you just say?
Whether it's a stretch that our female protagonist is Japan and Joe is the American influence that is corrupting her.
No, I don't think that's a stretch at all. But it's, I mean, if it comes down to, if we're looking for a metaphor, that's a pretty straight in your face metaphor.
Because moving forward, yeah, sorry.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, Spencer, I think the movie where somebody gets hit by a truck was either Wedding Ring, because that's the one with where Mifune's the doctor, right?
Is he? Yeah, he's a doctor.
Yeah.
In that. to Kinoyu Tanaka.
Yeah, a truck. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do, vaguely.
I don't know if that was Wedding Ring, but I think
it could be.
Yeah, I mean it's not important. The only other one that I thought it could have been was the lost episode of whatever the fruit one was. Summer.
Oh, Here's to the Young Lady. The episode I deleted from the thing that I don't feel like redoing the episode.
Yeah.
With someone else.
Anyway.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I think it does happen there. But the bookseller is and this was played by Fumiya Watanabe, and he plays the warden and female prisoner Scorpion 1 and 2. And either he was older than he looks here, or they did some age makeup, but he looks significantly older in those movies. And you see him play kind of a creepy scumbag, which isn't much of a stretch. And he gets, I think, both eyes poked out with a knife. But anyway,
he was in a ton of the classic series films from Japan. He was in like a Lone Wolf and Cub. He was in what's the name of the series? Sleepy Eyes of Death. That's what I'm trying to think of.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
But I think he's most famous for as an Oshima actor, right? They did like 11 movies together. He's most, like, you've seen a lot of movies like Cruel Story of Youth and Sun's Burial, Night and Fog in Japan. He's popping up left and right in those.
And
after this, thinking, of course.
Yeah. And he also did a lot of the kind of lower tier pink, like Pinku and exploitation-y stuff.
He was in Scandalous Adventures of Burakan too, also, but I don't remember who he was.
He's also the sex slaver in the Street Fighter, the Sonny Chiba movie. So there are themes cooking up in this movie, though, but when you guys dig into Seppuku and Rebellion, and if you ever get a chance to view The Human Condition, all 3-6 parts of The Human Condition, you'll just see like how he gets more into how the system is totally fucked, you know, and how things are just geared towards the many and not to the few, and how the individual kind of stands up against it. I think here he's got very important things to say and is very interested in them, but I think he does come up a little bit, as we kind of discussed, he comes up a little bit short. I think once he, you know, has kind of a bigger canvas to work with. This one, when he's working with Shinobu Hashimoto, who's, you know, one of the greatest screenwriters of all time.
Recently passed at the age of 101.
Rest in peace, yeah. He's very old. He's a legend, though. This one he's working with, what's his name, Zenzo Matsuyama, who wrote Tattered Wings for Kinoshoto, who, of course, was Kobayashi's mentor. And had written 4 films for Kobayashi up to this point, and then worked on The Human Condition before becoming a prolific director in his own right. But he definitely, once he hooks up with Hashimoto, and his ambitions just kind of get bigger, I think, like, he goes wild with these ideas, and just, like, and even Kwaidan, which is not, you know, one of these kind of thematic movies, but it's just a gorgeous movie. You guys really haven't seen Kwaidan? I'm really surprised.
I just haven't come across his work, because, like, before this podcast, when I would just watch random old Japanese movies through Netflix DVD, I just kind of never picked one of his. And then when I started his podcast, it kind of turned into, like...
Is that Spencer was always picking these movies, so it's all his fault. Okay. And as for Harakiri, I've had that on my list of must-watch for a long time, and now that Filmstruck is shutting down... I was like, I better watch some of the stuff that I wanted to. So I just watched it the other day, and I freaking loved it. So
I was going to use Filmstruck specifically to watch these movies for this episode. It was the worst timing ever.
Yeah.
It's but not. I'm not going to let it die. I'm going to go. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to make a deal with the devil or something like that.
Netflix DVD.
I'm going to say no. That's, I'm saving Filmstruck.
So is old Toro, but hopefully.
If anyone can do it, she'll do it. I know it.
Yeah. But Human Condition, I haven't I've been wanting to watch it, just like the subject matter and the runtime of it kind of for early on discouraged me a little bit, but
yeah, that would be daunting. Yeah, I totally get that.
But and
Qui-Gon,
up and I didn't know Noctai was in it until recently, so now I want to see it.
But Shimura's in it too.
Shimura, huh? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's even more of a reason. But Qui-Gon was the second, movie picked from Japan for best foreign film to feature Nakadai, and I think it did make it through, but it lost. The other one was Kinoshita, I forgot what it's called. And then Hideo Gosha had a couple movies with Nakadai that were picked for best foreign film. But they didn't make it all the way through.
That's a very specific category, foreign films that feature Nakadai.
Yeah, it's a weird thing I kind of noticed with the Gosha series I did. But, Fumio Watanabe is also in School of the Holy Beast, which is a really great, crazy exploitation movie. If you can handle, like, extreme... uncomfortable, weird exploitation, it definitely is worth watching. And he plays a corrupt priest in that.
That's a pretty wild acting career.
Oh, yeah. So, I believe you guys have some other 1957 movies.
Yeah, why don't you guys go ahead and
start it off. See, I don't remember what we talked about last time because that was a long time ago. So, I haven't seen that many 1957 films. Like, I'm looking at my list, and most of them are actually Warner Brothers animation, you know, Bugs Bunny type cartoons. So, like,
those are great films.
Oh, yeah, yeah, don't get me wrong. Yeah, yeah, like, there's a reason why I marked them all as watch, because they're amazing things. But I guarantee I talked about Canal last time, but I'm going to talk about it again because it is really amazing. It's directed by Andrzej Wajda, I want to say.
Oh, you did talk about it. I do remember it now.
Yes. And he's the same guy who did Ashes and Diamonds. And it's all done from the perspective of these people that are trying to escape... I don't know if it's concentration camp or just a prison camp, but they're, or not even that. I think that their city has been invaded by the Germans, and they're all trying to escape through these underground tunnels, and things are just going terribly, terribly wrong for them. Like, and it's shot so interesting. Like, we spend so much time in the tunnels, you get claustrophobic yourself. And, like, at first, it seems like you're going to be with these people that are brave and, like, you're cheering for them on. But they start making the kind of decisions that anyone would make in a situation where you're scared for your freaking life and getting, you know, animal reactions. Like, I heard a sound, so I'm going to run in this direction and possibly expose the group to... that is trying to hide from these people. And it's tense and it's really well acted, and I can't say enough. I think I'm going to watch it again right now. Goodbye.
Right. I'm going to repeat mine because I haven't seen anything else since a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
But mine is Desk Set with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. Where Katharine Hepburn is a librarian, a research person who works at like a TV network, and Spencer Tracy is a computer programmer guy who comes in, and he comes in because a company network is like, well, books are stupid. Let's have a big old computer that fills up an entire room. That will be better than books. And so it becomes a, like every Hepburn Tracy movie, a battle of the wills and big personalities, and it's not their best, but if you like their movies together, it is worth watching. There's one. Joan Blondell has a really good role. She's a Hollywood legend. She usually play like smaller parts, but Joan Blondell is phenomenal in that, and so is Sue Randall, who had a very interesting career. She was on some Twilight Zone episode, which she showed up with some big Hollywood studio stuff, and then I believe she quit acting because she wanted to raise a family. So her career kind of cut short voluntarily. And yeah, that's it. Slash, I want to... This is not 1957, but it's 1958, and I won't have another chance to talk about this on the show.
No.
Yes. Jacques Tati's My Uncle is from around this time, roughly, and it's a delightful Jacques Tati comedy. If you like Jacques Tati, you will like it. If you don't, it won't change your mind on him.
Why didn't you talk about it when we talked about Hidden Fortress and The Rickshaw Man?
I hadn't discovered my love of Jacques Tati yet.
Oh, sure.
I think you would like Jacques Tati, even though you hate comedy.
I mean, I don't hate comedy, I just don't like it.
All right.
Well, if you hate comedy, that's a good start for liking Jacques Tati, let me tell you.
Start with The Big Day. It's a whole lot of fun.
Shall I do another one?
Do it, Joel. Do it.
All right, that's it. You're up, John.
Okay, so 1957 was a great year for epic war movies. I think everyone knows David Lean's Bridge on the River Kwai and Kubrick's Path of Glory. They're quite rightly canonized, and Fuller actually had three war movies that year that came out, 40 Guns, China Gate, and Run of the Arrow. I guess 40 Guns is not technically a war movie, but Run of the Arrow and China Gate. But I'm going to recommend two that are lower budget, more intimate war films that are both masterpieces. One of them is Men in War, which is directed by Anthony Mann. And it's a story about, the poster, in fact, could be seen in Black River.
Oh, so interesting.
It's also connected to the film. Set in the Korean War with a lost platoon trying to locate their division, the 24th Infantry. Robert Ryan is in charge, and they're just completely decimated, exhausted, shell-shocked, just beyond repair, I think. I mean, they definitely are not, you know, a working platoon at this point. And then Aldo Ray shows up in a Jeep, and he is a completely cynical about the whole situation. He's ready to get the hell out of there. So there's this tension between he and Robert Ryan, who's still trying to kind of maintain order and keep this platoon together. They get attacked left and right by these almost phantom enemy soldiers who pop up out of, you know, bushes and just from anywhere, and it's almost like a horror movie as a war film. The Pentagon refused to cooperate with this movie. They hated the script so much. They thought it was, you know, demeaning to, you know, the whole military effort. So there are no, you won't see like any tanks or big artillery, anything that the, you know, Hollywood usually got from their military resources. It's, like I said, it's very stripped down. It's very very low budget, but a really effective film. And the other one is Nicholas Ray's Bitter Victory, which is a movie that I found out about when Chris Funderburg wrote a series for The Pink Smoke about Nicholas Ray. And he summed it up perfectly as a story of two men who hate themselves trying to get their opponent to feel an even deeper self-loathing. Because it pits Kurt Jurgens with Richard Burton as two soldiers who are a part of the Western Desert Campaign in Egypt. They accept a behind the enemy lines mission in Benghazi, which actually goes over perfectly the mission itself. It's a great action sequence. It's phenomenal. But then most of the rest of the film is them trying to get back across the desert. Someone's stolen the camels that they were supposed to get. So they're literally walking across the desert to get back to, you know, to home base. And it's these two guys who just hate each other. One of them is a coward who has no war experience whatsoever. And then Burton's character is this very savvy war soldier and spy who just uses his intellect to just belittle him at every turn. They're in love with the same woman back home. So there's that. And it's just so much fun to watch these two go at each other. And it's I'm not a huge Nicholas Ray fan, but this is just a phenomenal movie. And beyond the war films, I got to say Curse of the Demon, the Jacques Tourneur film, which is, or Night of the Demon, you might know it as if you live in England, because it is a terrific horror film. I'm actually going to be talking with it with Brian Sauer in an upcoming Just the Disc episode.
Oh.
To a large extent, because this is one of my favorite horror films of all time. Jacques Tourneur is great. And he's awesome. And the only other film I would mention, just to be as relevant to the show, is Suzuki's 8 Hours of Terror, which is a gangster version of Stagecoach, where set on a shuttle bus.
Oh.
With actors like Nobuo Kanako, who was in Ikiru, and Hisoka Ohara, who was in No Regrets for Our Youth. So a lot of Kurosawa actors popping up in this.
Nobuo was in the Battles with Honor and Humanity series.
She was. She's also in Black Rain, and she's the old lady who loves cherry blossoms in Koreeda's Afterlife. So
who's this Setsuko Hara lady? Never heard of her. You can't see me.
So those are some good 1957 movies.
Is the movie literally 8 hours long?
It is not.
Okay, just checking.
Should have been. It should have been.
I just realized we didn't talk about Throne of Blood compared to this exactly.
Oh yeah, well.
Yeah, I've kind of forgot that.
I mean, we're not done yet. I mean, do you see any obvious connections between the two?
But also, I didn't.
Besides the casting of the same actress playing the landlady and Lady Macbeth.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. I almost think it's a blatant like showing of what Kurosawa wanted to do, as opposed to what more up and coming directors were doing. You know, like you said, this is like how far into the career was Kobayashi? Yeah,
he started in the early 50s, so he. But he was very prolific, so he had about 5 or 6 movies under his belt at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, and Kurosawa doing Throne of Blood, like American influence, but he loved Shakespeare, so a period piece that's outside of when because there was that time period when they weren't allowed to do samurai movies, right? So that they must have let up on that for him to do this, obviously.
It was already over because right. Seven Samurai happened.
It's been almost a decade since the end of the, or it's been more than a decade since the end of the war. So I guess that makes sense.
It was 55 to like 45 to 53. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like it wasn't strictly enforced by the end. And when Seven Samurai happened, it was kind of like, well, fuck it. We can't really enforce this anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't, they don't feel like they share much.
It's interesting though, because Kobayashi, unlike Kurosawa, came from a theatrical background, but Kurosawa was the one who ended up adapting Shakespeare. So go figure. But yeah, I think Lower Deaths, which was released the same year, is probably a better comparison just because they're both set in the slum with all these kind of weird characters. And even though Lower Depths is more of a period piece than, you know, the post-war Japan setting, I think that I would say if you know, I had to make a comparison, I'd say Black River is like Pigs and Battleships meets Lower Depths in terms of its plot, its narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And, it's interesting Kurosawa did 2 theatrical adaptations this year, too. Mm-hmm. With Lower Depths, it's a Gorky play, and then a Shakespeare play.
Mm-hmm.
And then I believe Throne of Blood was so... it kind of got mediocre reviews and stuff, and not a big success. And so he's kind of like, well, I'll go back to like Seven Samurai again, and did Hand Fortress the next year.
You just can't win with those American critics, so.
No, this was like in Japan. It was at the time, it's kind of like not well received. It took a while for it to build up steam. Like a lot of classics now.
Can you imagine that? Can you imagine like Japanese critics going after a Kurosawa film while they're coming out? Like, why don't you go fuck yourself? I mean, this is Akira Kurosawa, man. Should get on the ground and thank your lucky stars that this guy exists while you're writing about films that you can anticipate a new Kurosawa movie next year, you know?
Yeah.
Hindsight, 2020.
Yeah, and Godard and all those guys in France were poo-pooing Kurosawa, but they idolized like Mizoguchi and not. I don't say Ozu wasn't exported outside Japan until after he died.
You know, jerking off to Hitchcock.
Yeah, basically. So that's about it. Next pairing is Drunken Angel, which is probably my favorite movie of all time, period. It's definitely way up there.
It's definitely your favorite Kurosawa movie.
Oh, yeah, easily my favorite Kurosawa. I know it's not technically the best, and it's Toshiro's first one with him, so and Toshiro is like maybe his third or fourth movie, so he still isn't that good of an actor, but he's still, it's still Toshiro. And comparing that with Women of the Night, the Mizoguchi movie. And they're both, hopefully it's a good pairing because they're both about post-war Japan. And there might be a guest on both of those, but I need to work things out if that's going to happen. And Film Struck will be dead by a point. We finish up that one. So Women of Night is on Netflix DVD, and it's on some Mizoguchi box set. I forgot which one. And Drunken Angel has its own separate release. I don't think it's on Blu-ray. It might be streaming on Amazon, but I have my own DVD copy that I got a couple of years ago. So.
Well, lottie freaking da.
Uh-huh. And let's see, John, you got anything that you, you're working on currently that's going to come out soon?
Well, let me just say before that, I just want to say how much I've enjoyed the Go Show series you've been doing over on Jailhouse 701, man. It's been terrific. Oh, really enjoyed reading those. I definitely love to see them. Yes, Hideo Gosha, sorry.
Yeah, the Go Show is a different person at all.
I'm just a big fan of the Go Show, so I always think about that. Hideo Gosha, I love it, and look forward to more of those. I need to get into his more of his films, because the four or five that I've seen are just phenomenal. So he's great.
I did all the decades of his career already. So
it's all done. All right, I'll go back and read the most recent one. Read the most recent one. I haven't gotten to it. It's fantastic. And our big news over at the Pink Spoke is that we started a second podcast that's literature-based. We're going to be talking about genre fiction or pulp fiction. Chris wants to take the name back. Mm-hmm. Science fiction, crime, horror books. So we just launched that, and we're having a good time with that. So that's what we're working on currently.
All right.
That's pretty radical.
Yeah.
And I'm excited. It's always a lot of fun to dig into that stuff.
Yeah, and you guys were just recently-ish on FlixWise Canada talking about Boonwell, which prompted me to finally watch some Boonwell, which, thank you very much. Boonwell is the best.
He's great.
That's awesome. I'm glad that you're finally digging into him. He's, the best. Absolutely.
Yeah, so far Simon and Desert, because it's 45 minutes long. I think that's a great starting point, and I'm kind of hooked now. So
that's great, man. I look forward to hearing more about what you think of the films as you watch them.
Yeah, and let's see. Jerome, don't you send people into space?
I'll send you into space.
Well, you have.
That's
recently.
I specifically prevented you from going into space. If you want to know the truth. So if you want to hear me talking about science fiction and fantasy movies, me and my co-host Aaron and Sarah, we talk about a different one every week at Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space. So most recently, we released an episode on... There's a problem. Like, for some reason, my brain is going blank because I'm thinking about like all the other movies I want to do for the podcast.
Snake Man.
Dreamscape. Thank you. Yes. So we talked about Dreamscape, which stars Dennis Quaid's ass.
Yeah, as, you talked about it most of the time.
Well, I mean, okay. During he has like a, in, like he basically does a complete violation of this woman by going into her dream while she's having some sort of sexy period piece dream thing, and he's just wearing the tightest white shorts for something like, you know, your eyes, if this movie was in 3D, your eyes would be poked out from those things, I swear. Luckily it wasn't. And that's a fun conversation that I think we went, we didn't really stay on script for that one, because like, there, if you watch that movie, it's got some great set pieces, but there's a lot of like kind of boring 70s spy stuff kind of going on, like not literally, but that's how it feels. And but it does give you a lot of things to talk about. And by the time this episode drops, we'll be talking about a requested episode on the movie Super Fuzz. Have you, either of you heard of that movie?
You told me about it last time we recorded. Mm-hmm.
I know about it. I've not seen it.
Okay, well, it's Italian made in America. It has Ernest Borgnine, but he's not the star. It stars an Italian actor who played Django in a couple of the sequels to the original.
Oh, no, not Franco.
Not Franco Nero. No. Okay. And he plays a police officer who gains superhuman powers due to being caught in a nuclear fallout. And all he uses his powers to stop crime? Question mark. He's kind of clumsy and funny, and it's very similar to the comedic style of Mr. Super Invisible, which is another one we did. That like just joke after joke after joke, like landing for kids, except for one really weird scene where he goes to a strip club, which makes it not for kids all of a sudden. The rest of the movie is kind of family friendly. And the whole thing's on YouTube, but that'll be coming out pretty soon.
Okay. You guys' output is crazy. Doing one a week like that, it's nuts.
Yeah, we just had to, like, this was basically my passion project, because I wanted something to be able to work on weekly that wasn't work. And I'd love to have you on sometime, John.
Oh, wow, that'd be great. I'd love to.
Ghost of Mars?
No, he has to specifically talk about Ghoulies Go to College. No, I don't know. Well, you get to pick the movie when you come on, of course.
Awesome, let's do it, man. Kevin McCarthy's in Ghoulies Go to College, I know that.
All right.
Let me just make one suggestion before we sign off real quick. I don't know if you guys noticed the weird sound effect in the scene in Black River when she's telling him about the assault, and then there's suddenly this weird chirping noise, and he, like, kills a bug.
Yeah.
Did you guys notice that? It's like a really, it's a really bizarre sound effect that he chooses. I was just gonna say, you should, if when you're editing this episode, if there are any like bits of dead air or whatever, you could just put that little weird chirping sound effect in there to close the gap.
See, for me on my sites, I said Cinema Knife Fight, but that website, I used to write for Cinema Knife Fight, but then it kind of died because technical stuff happened. But on my personal site, Jailhouse 701 Japanese Cult Cinema, because Filmstruck is dying, I decided to tackle some Filmstruck stuff I won't be able to watch easily for a while or ever. So I'm doing a Go Show double feature of the first fully sound Japanese film from 1931, Neighbor's Wife and Mine. A Go Show comedy with Kinuyo Tanaka, and then there's one from 1935 at Burden of Life. That's also kind of like a little drama comedy. They are interesting and very different, but also kind of very similar, and they're both just an hour long, so not much investment. Plus, Filmstruck won't be around for much longer, so, you know, just go watch those. They're good one-hour movies. And
R.I.P. Filmstruck.
Yeah, I postponed Samurai and Sarsaparilla because Filmstruck is dying. So, So next episode will be Drunken Angel, or it might be Okamoto's Kill, which we're trying to do that one before we're officially done with return guest Megan Dooley, because she requested that one. It has Nakadai in it, so I said, yes, we will probably do that. And that's it. John, thanks for your time.
Thanks, guys. It's always fun.
And I'll see you guys in a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podient. Thank you for listening.